This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. We'll start today with a question. Did you know that police and district attorneys in Massachusetts can legally seize your money and your property and never return them, even if you're cleared of any wrongdoing? It's possible under a process called civil forfeiture, and a new WBUR investigation in partnership with ProPublica is shedding light on the practice. Joining us now to talk about it is WBUR investigative reporter Shannon Dooling. Shannon, hello.
Hi, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining. And also with us is WBUR investigative data reporter Saurabh Dattar. Saurabh, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Shannon, I'll start with you. I gave the briefest definition there, but I do want to start with what we're actually talking about, what this actually is, civil asset forfeiture. What does it mean and what does it allow the police to do?
Sure. Well, the short answer is that civil forfeiture is, a legal process. And police and prosecutors use it to keep money and property that's been seized because they suspect it's connected with drug crimes. But again, the key word here is civil, and that means there doesn't need to be a drug conviction or even a drug charge in order for law enforcement to keep the cash and property, as you mentioned in the intro there. And so prosecutors in Massachusetts, interestingly, have a lower burden of proof than anywhere else in the country. They only need to show probable cause to hold on to the assets. And that's really what makes Massachusetts such an outlier when it comes to civil forfeiture laws.
So, Shannon, beyond the sort of larger question of what's right and justice, can this impact you even if you're not directly a suspect? Why is it important for all of us to understand the implication here?
Well, I think what surprises a lot of people is the fact there doesn't even need to be a criminal drug charge for the DA's office to be able to keep your money or your property. There's also this idea, and what we saw in our reporting, of innocent third parties, right? So the scenario where someone loans their car to a friend or a relative, that car is suspected of being involved in drug trafficking. And if the vehicle is seized as part of that investigation, it's now up to you, the owner of the car, to prove you had no idea it was being used for that purpose. And actually, you then need to meet a higher standard of legal proof than even the district attorney does. So, you're essentially guilty until you prove yourself innocent.
And you can lose your car forever.
Mm-hmm.
So in your story, which is, we have a link to at our website, radioboston.org, you mentioned that civil forfeiture gained popularity around the 70s. It was supposed to be this tool to fight the war on drugs, trying to financially weaken people like drug dealers. Of course, we know the state's laws around drugs have changed a lot since 1970s. So what is the 2021 justification for using civil forfeiture in this way in Massachusetts?
Well, law enforcement, they do break up drug trafficking rings, right? They seize that money through civil forfeiture. They're able to keep that money and reinvest it, into the community or into department training or other programs. But as our reporting shows, there are many instances in which money and property are being taken from either, low-level offenders or, like we've said, folks who are never even charged with a drug crime. And so civil rights advocates say the way to fix this is to get rid of civil forfeiture altogether, to require a criminal conviction before the DA's office and police can keep the money and property. And states across the country are moving in that direction. But, to date, Massachusetts hasn't really budged.
Shannon, I'm here at WBUR's studios. Saurabh and you are both joining me remotely. So I'm going to play some tape here for our listeners from your sources, from your reporting. The first voice we're going to hear is Louis Rulli. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, talking about the laws here in Massachusetts.
It's out of step with the country. It's out of step with our legal system. It's out of step with justice.
And here's a response from Worcester County District Attorney Joseph Early Jr.
We follow all the rules that the court gives us. We follow the case law that they give us. And look, our mission here is prevention, intervention, and public safety.
Professor Rulli, DA Early there, Shannon, two sort of opposite viewpoints on the legality and the morality of all this. Who's right?
Well, I mean, like we've said, civil forfeiture is completely legal in Massachusetts. The question critics pose is really whether or not it should be. You know, should law enforcement need a criminal conviction before they can keep someone's money and property? Should the money that DAs take in through forfeitures, which is in the millions, be rerouted out of their offices and into the state's general fund? I think ultimately legislators are going to need to answer some of those questions.
All right, you said it's in the millions. So, Sarab, let's dive deeper into the data here and, you know, get into what you discovered in your reporting. Why did you both decide to look at Worcester and extrapolate out your findings in Worcester for the rest of the state?
Sure. So we were looking at different places when we started out reporting this project. And Worcester is among the top three counties in the state when it comes to forfeiture cases and the money involved in those cases. So when we started looking at some cases in Worcester closely, we found this trend of the DA kind of packaging these really old incidents into big forfeiture cases. So we decided to take a look at the county in detail, and we looked at forfeiture cases filed in 2018, and we really found that nearly one in four incidents, so that's about 24%, for these forfeiture cases, they did not have a related drug conviction or a drug charge. And when these people still ended up losing money and property to law enforcement, we also found that the DA was waiting more than 10 years to even file a forfeiture case for hundreds of people in this county. So these people had to wait that long to even get a chance to try to get their money back.
Wow, 10 years. So then what does this actually mean for the state?
So experts told us that it's kind of a reflection on how the laws on the books need to be updated, because there's no real time frame for filing a forfeiture. And the fact that the bar is so low for law enforcement to keep your property here, regardless of whether you're guilty of a crime or not.
So just to be clear, you may have property seized, but never get the chance to get it back and never be charged.
That's possible, yes.
It's a big deal. So I'm wondering if you could just pull back the curtain a little bit for our listeners and just get into how you went about reporting this story and gathering all that information and data.
Sure. So involved a lots of trip to Worcester. Shannon and I went to Worcester several times to the courthouse, lots of manual cleaning up of data. So we looked up literally every single forfeiture case filed in Worcester County in 2018. And then we mapped that and looked up the underlying criminal case. So, and now these are typically two different court systems. So it's not like if you look up the forfeiture case, you know what criminal case it is. So you have to look that up separately. And we looked at every single district court in Worcester County. And that involved looking up nearly 400 incidents. And I also wrote some code to extract and like kind of pull out some seizure dates from these case files. And I put it all in a spreadsheet for the analysis. So it really involved a lot of careful data collection, manual verification, and analysis for the whole process. It was quite labor intensive.
Yeah, so the sort of good old-fashioned gumshoe reporting mixed with modern data collection. It's fascinating. So, and it has a huge impact. And how big is that impact? How much money are we talking about here?
So the trial court of the state has done an analysis of this very question. And so they found that from fiscal year 2017 through 19, more than $20 million in property was forfeited involving more than 2,700 cases for Massachusetts. So it's not small change that we're talking about here. And this money is important for the district attorneys as well. And we've talked to district attorneys who told us that this money is a significant part of their budgets for some really key programs like witness protection and investigations. So this money seems like it's a very important part of their operations.
So they're depending, you're saying, on this money to fund police operations.
I think they told us that if the legislature goes ahead and makes some recommendations, or if the laws are changed, they're going to have to think about how their budgets will be filled, because there'll be a shortfall.
And Shannon, do we know yet who is most impacted by civil forfeiture?
Well, as Sarb said, we looked at hundreds of forfeiture cases and the seizures associated with them. And, you know, the median amount in Worcester County between 2017 and 2019 was around $400. That's, you know, the median amount of how much money was seized from individuals. But we saw some cases, Jamie, in which police seized as little as $10 from a 14-year-old boy. And that money was kept. So, you know, critics argue the hardest hit by civil forfeiture tend to be people who can least afford it. And as far as a breakdown by race, law enforcement in Massachusetts doesn't track that information in records. So that's a difficult one to quantify, but we're working on figuring out how to do just that.
And Shannon, I know this is in your reporting, but, you know, for someone whose property is taken by this method, what's the typical way that law enforcement reaches out potentially to get it back? Do you understand my question?
Yeah, sure, I do. So by law, DAs have to, you know, try to notify somebody that they intend to keep their property or their money. And there's two ways that a district attorney can do that in Massachusetts. One is by sending a certified letter to the last known address for someone. And so, you know, logically, one would think that if there's an address on an arrest report, for instance, or in the DMV, that's, you know, the address the district attorney would try to send a certified letter to. We found that because of some of the delays that we talked about, you know, waiting decades to file these notices, a lot of people aren't at the same address, and it can be really difficult to track them down. So the other way, if there isn't a known address for someone, the other way that a district attorney legally can try to notify somebody is by listing it in a classified ad in a local newspaper. And so
very 2021.
Yes. In our story, one of the gentlemen we speak with, you know, he actually, his charges had been dismissed 4 years prior to the district attorney in Worcester filing a forfeiture case, you know, officially trying to keep his money. And the way that he was supposed to have been notified was by an ad in the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, in which his name appeared along with hundreds of other people who had money in the custody of the DA. And it's in minute font. And, you know, he told us, I don't even read the newspaper. You know, how am I supposed to be looking out for a notification about how I want to get my money back? You know, so that's troubling to a lot of critics as well.
So, Sara, you know, how do you think, a little analysis here, how do you think this report will affect how legislators move forward on this issue?
So I think, as I mentioned, there was a state commission to kind of try to reform or recommend some changes to civil forfeiture laws in the Commonwealth. They recently came out with a report. But we were able to get actually much more information than what they did. We got more data on conviction rates. We got instances of delays in filing cases, both of which I'm not sure if the commission touched upon that much. So we'll have to wait and see how they respond to these findings.
And finally, Shannon, just in a couple seconds here, what's next on the reporting on this?
Well, I mean, I think we'll reach out to legislators who were involved in that commission that Sarb mentioned and sort of gauge their response to these findings, right? These wait times and the statistics that we showed about criminal convictions related to civil forfeitures. And I've already seen some chatter on social media of folks who have been involved in that state commission. You know, the Massachusetts Bar Association, I believe, was one of the groups who said, look, we need the legislature to move this effort forward. We need them to put these recommendations into place. But as Sarb said, that's a heavy lift and will remain to be seen, I guess, to, you know, how much action the legislature will take.
Well, we'll stay tuned to your reporting. That's WBUR investigative reporter Shannon Dooling and WBUR investigative data reporter Sarb Datar. Shannon, Sarb, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
A quick disclaimer here. For the next 10 minutes or so, we'll be discussing rape and sexual assault, because thanks to a bill that became law just a couple of weeks ago, thousands of backlogged rape kits in Massachusetts will soon be tested for the first time. The over 6,000 kits are part of a pileup that stretches all the way back to 2000. And joining us now to discuss the bill and its impact on survivors is its sponsor, State Representative Natalie Higgins. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Kim Dawkins, president of Pathways for Change, a rape and sexual assault crisis center that services dozens of communities in central Massachusetts. Kim, it's good to have you as well.
Hello, Jamie. It's great to be on.
Thank you both for joining us. Representative Higgins, I do want to start with you, just so that we're all on the same page here. Briefly, what do we mean when we say rape test kits?
So these are sexual assault evidence kits that are collected usually between 3 and 5 days after an assault in a hospital. And they're the evidence that documents the trauma perpetrated upon a survivor's body.
So the legislature back in 2019 passes a bill that includes funding for testing backlogged rape kits here in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
But at the beginning of this year, you filed a bill to test some 6,300 kits that were excluded from testing under that original bill. Why weren't these kits ever tested? What happened?
So we're still trying to get answers about how we got here. And I did not do this alone. I'm really thankful to have a partner in Minority Leader Brad Jones working on this issue. And we kind of agreed we didn't care how we got here, but we needed to move forward. And we had these 6,300 kits that weren't tested or weren't fully tested, weren't DNA tested. And we wanted to make sure that we removed any loopholes or any language that the crime lab was pointing to that said that they could not test the kits.
So this year's bill, what is the state doing to comply?
Yeah, so we require the crime lab to take an accounting of the kits. There are a number of kits that they continue to claim cannot be tested. There are at least one category where that is the case, that the DNA evidence in the kit is so small that it would be exhausted. There's a separate process that needs to go through. The frustrating part is we haven't been able to get an accounting of how many kits fit that profile and need to be put aside. They've had $8 million. They've spent, we believe, about $4 million of it, and they've had 2 additional years and haven't come up with a plan to test the kits that can legally be tested. And that's what we're really asking for. And so we put stricter timelines, more accountability, quarterly reports to make sure that these kits are being tested, that there's a plan. And we know it may take a few years because there are 6,300 kits, but we need a plan. And survivors and their loved ones deserve to know how this backlog is going to be addressed.
So I do want to note that we have put in a request for comment to the state police crime lab, and we have not yet received a response. I guess I'm just wondering what you're hearing in terms of why not just do this?
I don't think that we've heard a real compelling argument other than that we can't. And we've said, we're the legislature, we'll write the legislation, we'll give you the money, we'll give you the resources, and we want you to do this. We think this is good public policy, and other states are doing exactly this. And we want to make sure that we're treating every single sexual assault evidence kit with the care and dedication it deserves.
So Kim Hawkins, let me bring you in here.
Sure.
Talk about what this testing means to survivors.
Well, Jamie, I think one of the most important things is the question that survivors ask often is why aren't they being tested? And if you think about it, most of us would agree that rape is one of the most horrific violations that can happen to anyone. And yet, societally, we still tend to minimize crimes of rape. We know that it's an internal weapon of war very often. It's often a sure laugh at a comedy club. And so I think to answer that question in this specific regard around the testing of rape kits is, as a society and as this is one of the most serious crimes that goes largely uninvestigated, the society's attitudes culturally toward sexual violence in general is not to take it seriously. So one of the most powerful messages to me in testing all kits is that offenders would get the clear message that law enforcement is serious about sexual violence and using the evidence to apprehend and prosecute perpetrators.
Because these kits they're essentially DNA evidence, right, that could be used to solving subsequent or other crimes.
Correct. And we also know that perpetrators predominantly are repeat offenders. So very often, you know, you can test a kit and it can lead you to a perpetrator of not just one crime, but multiple crimes. And I think the other important message for survivors around testing all kits is that it gives them the clear message that says that they and their case matters. And right now, by not testing, certainly for survivors, it's multiple layers of trauma, because survivors have already suffered so much to even get to the place of having the forensics evidence collected, and then to go back and discover that that kit is sitting on a shelf or missing or destroyed is devastating.
Representative Higgins, could I ask, you know, this idea that they're sitting on a shelf after being submitted, are sexual assault survivors informed of the status of their kits, or is it possible that they may not even know that their kits have not been tested?
One of the arguments that we've heard from the crime lab is that, well, survivors aren't coming to us and asking for their kits to be tested. And I quickly kind of shoot back, they have no idea that their kits aren't tested, right? What other violent crime would a victim think, well, let me just go back to that law enforcement agency and make sure they really took my
after years
seriously.
Yeah.
Like, let's make sure they really took my evidence seriously and tested it to the full extent. For a variety of reasons, we find ourselves here. But the clearest thing that we can do to say we believe survivors, we support survivors, and we honor the trauma that they've endured, we've got to test these kids.
So I mentioned at the top that this can be traumatizing and re-traumatizing. So I appreciate you both joining us to talk about this. And I'm wondering, someone out there who might not know the status of their kit, assuming that it had been tested,
well,
how to handle that trauma, that re-traumatization?
Yeah, Jamie, I'd love to jump in here, and I'm sure Representative Higgins would agree with me that we always say, certainly in the rape crisis centers, and there are 17 across the Commonwealth, that anyone who is thinking about that and has not yet done that or is considering doing that, to reach out to their local rape crisis center to get the really vital and important support that they can have through this process while they and if they decide that they want to pursue what happened to that evidence and follow that. I think that is critical in the for victims and survivors of sexual violence.
Rep Higgins, if I may, I know that this is emotional. And I learned from our producer, Amanda Beeland, that you're a former rape crisis counselor and a survivor of assault yourself. And I'm just wondering how your life experiences inform your commitment to this work.
Oh, I think you cut out for a second, but I think I got the gist. I mean, for me, I'm really thankful for the opportunity to be able to continue to work with organizations like Pathways for Change on the policy side of this and to bring survivor stories forward. But I will admit, having done this work for more than a decade, I'm frustrated that we're continuing to have these conversations about why it's really important that we test sexual assault evidence kits, why it might stifle survivors from coming forward if the kits aren't being fully tested, if that's learned, that these are just the 6,300 kits that were reported to law enforcement. There are 8,000 other kits in the crime lab that weren't reported to law enforcement and weren't tested, like mine. Hmm. And we're not even getting to that yet. I would love to have a conversation about that, but we're still fighting over this very, very small percentage of kits where someone knew that they could have a sexual assault evidence kit collected generally within 72 hours of a sexual assault and had the courage and the supports to be able to report that assault to the police. That is such a small percentage of the sexual violence that happens in our communities.
Yeah, I agree. And I would say from the Rape Crisis Center, too, to piggyback on what Representative Higgins just stated, that it is imperative and important to also understand that rape crisis centers that work with survivors, knowing that this is actually an expectation that the kits be tested, that if we tell survivors, yes, your kit will be tested, and then it is not, now you have destroyed the trust that you have built with the survivor. Mm. So if this continues to happen where the Commonwealth is not doing what it really should be doing, then survivors will start not coming forward, they won't go to get forensic evidence, you know, taken, that the problem becomes bigger and amplified when we're not doing what we know we need to do.
So final question for both of you, same question. What would you like to see change long-term for sexual assault survivors? I'll start with you, Rep. Higgins.
I'm really hopeful that we're going to be in a place where we give survivors the option to have their kit tested, fully tested, DNA tested, whether or not they report their assault to the police at the initial collection of the kit. And that's something I'm working on. I am heartened with our rape kit tracking that it looks like we will not have a backlog going forward, and that's from 2018 on. And so that's a really good place to start from. But I'm hopeful that we can continue to have more conversations about how we empower survivors through all of these processes.
And Kim, can you maybe offer just some resources real quick here for our listeners?
Yes, be happy to, and agree with Rep. Higgins on all of that. Some things that your listeners can reach out to are endthebacklog.org. That gives a lot of information around this issue. And also I'm thinking about in terms of the victim notification piece as we move forward and hopefully do create the change that Rep. Higgins has already mentioned. To empower survivors and to continue that important work, we also need to train law enforcement and others on how best to and when to notify victims and how we do that and when we do that, because there's a lot of conflict and confusion, and it's a complicated issue. And so we need to be having those conversations as well moving forward.
We'll have a link to that website on our website, radioboston.org. That's Kim Dawkins, president of Pathways for Change, and State Representative Natalie Higgins. Kim, Representative Higgins, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you.
If there's been one constant during this pandemic, it seems to be change. Changing risk, changing rules and guidelines, even a changing virus. And today we're going to talk about how those changes have impacted work, where we work, how we work, and what office-like life looks like. It's part of an ongoing series of conversations we'll have on Radio Boston about work as Delta cases rise and offices attempt to reopen. In a few moments, we'll take your calls. What is your office doing? Are you returning to your desk? Are you staying home, quitting, or changing jobs because of the return-to-office policies? And if you've been going in this whole time, maybe working in a different field than office work, call us. We want to hear from you as well. The number, as always, is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. First, we're going to turn to Katie Johnston. She's a business reporter for the Boston Globe, covering work and income inequality. Katie, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, you know, early in the pandemic, it seemed like offices and businesses went whole hog on this work from home forever thing. Then earlier this year, it seemed like a backtracking. Let's get everybody back at their desks. Where are we now in August 2021 on that spectrum here in the Boston area from your reporting?
Well, everything is very much in flux, as you note. A lot of people that had been planning to go back after Labor Day are delaying that to later in the fall or next year. There's a lot of different offices that have already started implementing, you know, we're going to do all remote, we're going to do hybrid. And the hybrid thing is all over the map, right? It can look very different in different places. Some are saying, come into the office a few days, stay home a few days. It's up to you when you want to do it. Other people are giving you specific remote only days, in-office days.
So things like flexibility is the key.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Are you seeing shifting trends in where people are choosing to live and work? I'm thinking, you know, Boston area businesses, are they thinking differently about location, commuting, and where their employees are physically based?
Right. I mean, some companies have given up office space altogether, and they've started working in WeWork spaces, optional, you know. Some places are saying work from home forever or will be digital first. And they're either giving up their offices altogether or you know, allowing for collaboration. And a lot of are just scaling back. Like Loomis Sales just announced that it was going to occupy about a third less space than it does now, giving up a couple floors because they've been so successful at it. And the suburbs are getting a little bit of a lift out of this. You know, the suburban offices had more activity during the pandemic than those downtown, in part because people could drive there instead of cramming into public transportation. And so the WeWork space or co-working spaces in the suburbs have actually grown while they've shrunk in the Boston area.
You've also reported on new office workers, you know, folks fresh out of college, and what they expect from office work versus seasoned folks who worked in person, then have been home and are now facing the prospect of return. Could you just tell us a little bit about what you're hearing from new office workers?
Right. Well, the college graduates are interesting because many of them they're just starting their careers, obviously, and many of them want to be around other employees they can learn from. They're also looking to make social connections, make friends, especially if they're in a new place, which is harder to do over Zoom. And they also tend to live in small apartments with roommates, and they might not have a good work setup at home. But of course, some also love working from home as well, like the rest of us.
Well, Katie, you've given us a lot to think about, so thank you. That's Katie Johnston. She's a business reporter for the Boston Globe, covering work and income inequality. Katie, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, listeners, what does the future of your office look like? What would you like it to look like? Have you changed jobs during the pandemic, and why? Again, call us and share your experiences and thoughts. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let me see if I can squeeze in a quick call here. We've got Kat calling from Worcester. Kat, you're on Radio Boston.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Pretty good. The best way to describe what I do, which everyone will understand, I'm a social worker. So I help people with filling out paperwork, going grocery shopping, going to doctor's appointments, etc. So I've been working through the whole pandemic. Our company had us work remotely for 2 weeks, and that was it.
Hmm. So you've been going door to door this whole time. Have you felt safe?
It wasn't really. Now that you're talking about it, I'm a little emotional.
It's okay.
I never really felt safe, but that's not my commitment. My commitment is to make sure people can eat and get to their doctor's appointments. So I just dealt with my commitment, not how I was feeling.
Well, Kat, thank you so much for doing it, and thank you for calling us. I want to squeeze in another call here. Before we get to our next guests, we have Joseph calling from downtown Boston. Joseph, you're on Radio Boston.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's your office? What's your work doing?
Yeah, so I'm a robotics engineer by trade, which is interesting because it really depends day to day. Some days I need to be in, you know, putting nuts to bolts, and some days I'm just sitting on a computer writing code. So some days I need to be in the office, some days I don't. And the company I work for is still deciding and trying to figure out its long-term policy. Right now, they're requiring, you know, a certain percentage of time in the office, which is a way to do it, I guess.
Do you like that?
But
do you want that?
Yes, I would prefer, I think honestly it should be done by a team by team, basis, and, you know, because, you know, someone on the software team, you know, the percentage of time they need to be in the office is going to be a lot lower than someone who's on, you know, the hardware team, you know, physically building things.
Right.
But we started as a startup before the pandemic. You know, we had, you know, 15 employees, but during the startup we've expanded and, you know, grown up, and we're bumping up a little over 30 now. And the problem we run into is there's just no seats in the office.
And, space issues.
You know, yeah. They're trying to get people to go in there. And we've signed a lease on new space, and it's being built out, but we won't be able to get there for a few months. And I'm honestly really afraid that once we have office space, there's going to suddenly end, you know, hopefully Delta will have passed. You know, there's going to be a big push to, all right, everyone in the office all the time. And honestly, I don't know if I'm ready to go back to that because the flexibility.
I hear you, Joseph. No, I thank you. You've put a lot on the table there. And yeah, I don't know if a lot of folks are ready to go back to that. And I don't know where Delta's going, but we'll stay tuned to it. I do want to bring in our next guests here. We have Segun Idowu. He's president and CEO of the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. Segun, welcome back to Radio Boston. I don't know if we have Segun, but I'm going to go to Lauren Jones, Executive Vice President at Massachusetts Business Roundtable. Lauren, welcome to you.
Great to have you, or great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And do we have Segun? No, we don't have Shigun yet. Okay, that's okay. Lauren, let me just ask you. You've been listening. You heard Katie. You heard our couple of callers here. And we've got a few more lining up here at 1-800-423-8255. Does that jive with what you're hearing from your members?
There's definitely a lot of things, especially what Katie spoke to and what she's been covering, that is consistent with what we're hearing from our employers. There's a lot in flux. There's been a lot of change, as you noted. I think employers are trying to stay nimble. While companies may have had plans to return to the office after Labor Day or sometime in the fall, those changes, those plans have had to quickly put on pause or change in light of the Delta variant. And I think first and foremost, employers are members of the Massachusetts Business Roundtable in particular, are focusing first and foremost on the health and safety of their employees and making sure that as they think about the work environment, that they are doing so with that in mind.
Right, right. And obviously, it all depends on the size of the business, the type of business, as we heard from some of our callers here. But in terms of new office policies, what are your members telling you about what they expect to see in September?
Well, some companies are continuing in September with what has been either fully remote or hybrid. So back in the spring, we actually surveyed our members. Our members represent major employers in Massachusetts, and our membership includes CEOs and senior executives of these large companies, from healthcare to life sciences, academia, financial services, across industries. And what we found was pre-pandemic, 90% of our members were working in operations here in Massachusetts, predominantly in person. And that completely shifted during the pandemic, certainly. But they anticipate that shift to continue post-pandemic, with about 79% of those same respondents looking to switch to a hybrid work model. And that is what will be the plan whenever they bring everyone into that new work environment. For those who can work remotely, I think many of our employers are trying to monitor what is happening and thinking about what those policies will look like. And then at the same time, like Joseph mentioned, there are some companies that have employees who have to be in the office, like right. In labs and actually touching and working on products or with teams. And so with that, companies are also being diligent and vigilant in making sure that those who are coming into the office are able to do so as safely as possible.
Right. So let me turn that to Shigun Iduwo, president and CEO of the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. When we talk about return to work, return to the office, we are leaving out a whole swath of essential, important Massachusetts businesses. We heard already from a caller who was been out there this whole time. So what are you hearing from folks who have been open this whole time, businesses that weren't able to go remote a year and a half ago?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I have to apologize for the technical difficulties.
Quite all right. We've become very used to it here.
Right. and to your point about the original caller or the earlier caller, I want to thank Kat for all that she has been doing for the Commonwealth. And, as we're talking about the future of work, on the side of Black businesses in particular, but businesses owned by people of color, a lot of folks, like you said, have not been able to close their doors over the last 18 months. Many of our businesses are Main Street's businesses. It's restaurants and barbershops and hair salons and it's dry cleaners. And a lot of them have relied on the foot traffic around the downtown Boston area, Nubian Square, et cetera, of folks being in the office. And so as we're talking about, folks being able to work from home, et cetera, the decreased footprint and decreased foot traffic in these areas is going to have a huge negative impact on our businesses. I think of one business in Nubian Square, who I won't call out, but I know that her restaurant or food business is located right in the bowling building. And so that business has relied on the 1,000 plus folks who work and move through that building working for BPS. And because very few people have been coming into the building, those catering opportunities, the lunch and breakfast opportunities of Selena, the folks in the building, have dramatically decreased. And so now the scramble is on to try to not only find new contracts, but to stay open in general. So certainly our businesses who have been open this whole time are thinking about how to survive if we move toward folks, most folks working from home.
Right, right. 1-800-423-8255. What is work looking like for you this September, moving into the fall? Give us a call, share your experiences, your thoughts. Have you changed jobs? Are you thinking of changing jobs? What is your office doing? 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Donna in Dorchester. Donna, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hi, I have a quick question for the man from the Commonwealth. I just was curious too, like, why, if the city can do anything to pair with the restaurants that need to offer food and, you know, or, you know, services, and catering to people and match them with people who are in need, and maybe they can supplement that, income. Like, is there any innovative way that they can make that happen? There's a ton of money being poured into the state all the time and donations, but it seems like they always just fall into, you know, people's pockets in the wrong way. So I'm just wondering, you know, like, if there's anything that could happen there.
Got it. Okay, Donna. Well, thank you for the call. So, Shigun, how about this idea of more funding, more money from the state, support businesses and employees?
Mm-hmm. Well, Donna from Dorchester, thank you very much for that question. And I promise you, Jamie, that was not a planted question, but it was an excellent one. You know, there is an important organization in the city of Boston called Commonwealth Kitchen, led by a phenomenal woman, Jen Fagel. And she has been working, she and her team have been working tirelessly to partner with the Commonwealth, to partner with Boston and other municipalities in the state to do exactly that, to ensure that restaurants who have seen a decreased amount of folks patronizing their businesses or who aren't able to do the delivery options to instead compensate that by having them feed those who don't have adequate access to food options. So that's certainly something that's being done. But to your point about just supporting the state, supporting our businesses, you know, BECMA in particular, but our partners as well, and the Coalition for an Equitable Economy and so many others have been every week pushing the state to make grants and other types of capital available to our businesses, because the Delta variant is destroying the future prospects of our businesses. In fact, you know, I think they would let me share here on radio that, you know, I spoke to about 10 or 12 Black restaurants just a few weeks ago. Many who we know, and when we think of where to go in Boston to get a you know, Southern delicacy or Italian food, et cetera, you know, these are the restaurants that come to mind. And they all told me, well, by the end of August, we're going to have to close our doors because they're not getting the support that they need. And so, you know, it's important that we're providing this capital as soon as possible to help save our businesses.
1-800-423-8255. Do you run a business? Where do you work? How are you working? What is work going to look like to you moving into the fall? Lauren, I want to turn to you here and ask you about sort of physical spaces, because we talked about this with Katie Johnson from the Boston Globe, of offices, you know, relocating, maybe people relocating. What are you hearing from members about the work that's going into physical spaces to make employees feel safe returning?
We are hearing that employers are evaluating and thinking about the purpose of the physical workspace, the layout and design of their office space, and, you know, their footprint here in Massachusetts. And in good news, and we heard from our members earlier this spring, 88% of our members expressed plans to stay here in Massachusetts, expand or relocate here in Massachusetts. So there's certainly a strong commitment within the business community to continue to thrive and do business here. If they are considering plans of relocating or what their footprint looks like, it's not because of a reduction in headcount, but really thinking more about what that collaborative space can be to bring people together. And I think employers are also realizing that that physical office space really needs to have a purpose for why their employees would come together. And the importance of putting quality and human interest first in the spirit of that in-person work environment. And I think that also is true for how companies have been thinking about their culture and their organization in bringing together their employees remotely in the virtual times as well.
Yeah. So let's get into a little bit of that, the sort of social aspect of work. You know, so many companies before the pandemic have put a big focus on office culture, DEI, morale, team building, perks. As we sort of move into maybe a more hybrid type world, Shagun, how can employees and employers continue to foster that healthy culture and that growth?
Intentionality at the end of the day, particularly on the DEI focus, and continuing to keep the door open to those conversations, you know, especially for Black and Brown workers, it's going to be important that no matter what the decision is, whether it's to have a hybrid approach for everyone to work in the office or to work from home, that employers are keeping in mind the health and mental health and well-being of their employees, particularly employees of color, where, you know, COVID has really devastated our communities, all of our communities, of course, but, you know, ours in a particular way. And so, like I said, just keeping those lines of communications open for folks to be able to chat about how they're feeling, to offer their thoughts on how to make their workplace more open and, you know, just open to them to feel as if they're welcome. All of that's going to be important as we're moving forward.
And Lauren, what's next? What do businesses and workers need from state leaders, from the government, moving into September? What are you looking for from our leadership?
Well, I think employers are certainly paying attention to what state government is doing here in Massachusetts, but I think they're also thinking about their employees and what their leadership within their corporations can look like so that whether it's in September or 6 months from now, their employees can feel like they are part of a thriving community and a safe environment to be working. In terms of state government, we work closely with the state. And I think if anything, we find that opportunities to focus on workforce development. One thing we didn't get a chance to talk about was the importance of talent development and making sure that there's opportunity of retaining talent, growing talent, and ways that we can partner with the state to provide workforce training for both incumbent workers as well as those that are unemployed looking for work, because that's a huge part of the future of work as well.
Well, that's Lauren Jones, Executive Vice President at Massachusetts Business Roundtable. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Shagun Iduwo, President and CEO of the Black Economic Council of Massachusetts. Thank you as well. This was great.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beeland, and Cynthia Betubisa, with help from Ali Audette and Stephen Gelman. Marquise Neal is our technical director. We had David, the Cavs of Belleville Green, on the phones today. Our executive producer is Satesh Hathi. I'm Jamie Bologna, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.